The upcoming program is a recording of a live event at the Community Hall in Woods Hole, Massachusetts in June of 2025. It was the culmination of a storytelling workshop for scientists organized by the Transom Story Lab and Atlantic Public Media. The trainer and director was Meg Bowles. Producers Sophie Crane and Vicky Merrick. Our musicians were Carla Kilstead and Matthias Bossy of Rabbit Rabbit Radio, and you'll hear from them in the second half. I'm Jay Allison, your host for the evening, and this recording has been trimmed only a little for time to fit on the radio. Our audience is made up of mostly members of the Woods Hole community. You may hear a fairy horn in the background. That's a feature of our village. Welcome. Enjoy the show. My name's Jay Allison. I have raised five kids here in Woods Hole. I've been here, it seems like a long time. I have a mooring. We had some people over recently, and we were asking about their family history in Woods Hole, and they said, my grandfather, I don't really talk about him. He had three moorings, but he gave them away before he died. So that's his legacy. I started an organization called Atlantic Public Media, which it's Project Transom, and we have been in the Davis House, which some of you locals may know about, up at the end of the road here for about 25 years. We've been in existence about 30. We're a nonprofit. We started WCAI. We started PRX, which is a distribution system for public radio. And then we produced lots of series like This I Believe and The Moth Radio Hour, which we're sort of borrowing some moth vibe for this. We were going to call it Lepidoptera, but we didn't. I just want to say why we're here. Like, we're here partly because I think it's time to pull together. I think there are any number of us laboring in different fields, teachers, historians, artists, social workers, journalists, public media, scientists, all of whom are under threat right now. All the people doing really good work to try to help each other and the planet are under threat. So it's time to like pull together and lend to each other our skills. And we love Woods Hole, and we love the science community, and we've been wanting, we do a bunch of sciencey things over the years, but this was a long time dream. And I'm just thrilled to be able to reach across to unsilo ourselves a little bit and connect across the usual boundaries. Let's see, I want to introduce you to Sophie Crane. She can just stand up and then you can talk to her. She's leading the Transom Story Workshop. She's right in back there. She's waving her hand. And she's here in Woods Hole a lot, also in Vermont, also has a baby, and driving back at midnight tonight after this, and is substantially responsible for putting on this event. And you can find out more about everything we do at transom.org and atlantic.org. And I won't go on too long about all that stuff, but we're pretty great. And anyway. All right, these storytellers have come, they came for a two-day workshop. They came, like, they leapt out of their comfort zone, which is in the field or in a laboratory, or it's doing things that are fact-based, data-based, and then they've moved into maybe what is antithetical to science, which is anecdote and story and narrative. And yet, we feel strongly like that scientists, it's very important for scientists to be able to effectively tell their stories, especially now, and to have everyone understand that that scientists are human beings. Because I think there's a feeling as though scientists are something apart and not to be trusted, or elitist, or experts, or better than others. And we want to break that down. And that's done with humanity. That's what we do at The Moth. You just do a shared humanity, and everybody understands, oh, wait, they're kind of like me. Or they're completely unlike me, and that's okay. Carla is our timekeeper. If the story goes long at all, she will urge the end of the story like this. Were that not to be enough, if they persist and drive that story into the wall, they will get this. Yeah, right. So that won't happen. Our theme is making waves tonight. I really feel like these people are incredibly brave. They're not storytellers. You know, this is their first time doing this. And because they're out of their comfort zone, you guys are their comfort zone. And I know that you will embrace them with just the very sound of your breath and your laughter and your applause. But we're going to start here. And each time, if you can like buoy them up and make them feel absolutely as if they're in a place where they are completely comfortable, even if they thought they wouldn't be, that's your job. These are your microphones up here. Neumann mics, very high quality, okay? So don't mess it up. I'm going to have we asked a question of each storyteller. And the question is, when was a time you were in too deep? Our first storyteller is Jinsi Over. And she said, during the pandemic, I bought myself a winemaking kit and corking set to make dandelion wine and then needed to pick 2 full quarts of dandelion petals for my recipe, which was more dandelion petals than I had easy access to. And mama didn't raise no quitter, so I had to resort to trespassing and got caught. Welcome, Jinsi Over.
As a child, I was obsessed with Legos. But I was also an only child, which meant that my early relationship with Legos was wholly selfish. They were mine, and they were mine alone. I hated the thought of other children coming over, breaking, mixing, getting their sticky little fingers over my Legos. And so when these other children inevitably showed up at my house for holiday parties, dinner parties that my parents threw, I would be frantically running up and down the stairs, ferrying my sandcrawler, my pirate ship, the castle, up into the relative sanctuary of my room, just so sticky fingers didn't put Harry Potter in the Millennium Falcon. And when I was entering the summer before my 7th grade, my father, a geology professor at SUNY Geneseo in upstate New York, he got a wave tank. And this was awesome because it is a giant raised sandbox. You have this water circulating, you have motorized paddles, and you can recreate these meandering streams, these deltas, and with a little creative dune building, you have this beach and with waves to complete the imagery. And this is all fun and fine, but my father taught environmental science 101, and for his lab, he needed a developed shoreline. And to do so, he wanted my Legos. And I was like, no. There's no way I'm letting hundreds of strangers pick apart my sets. And so he used his summer research student against me. She was my teen idol. We're talking flannels in the lab, 2 eyebrow piercings, snake tattoo up her arm. She was so cool. And at one of these summer barbecues, my father held them every week, she came up to me and she was cheerfully like, Jinsi, oh my gosh, I hear we're using your Legos in the wave tank tomorrow. That is so awesome. And oh, I was so blindsided. But I saw on my father's face the smallest of smiles, and I knew I had been played. But there was also no way I was gonna be uncool. Like, so as nonchalantly as possible, I'm like, yeah, it is pretty awesome, isn't it? And so true to my word though, the next day I got 2 full brimming tubs of Legos together and we went to the wave tank. And that morning we decided we were gonna recreate the Long Island coast. And so we broke apart these sets and we made mansions where Batman, Ronaldo, like Darth Vader had these mansions, and we built these Lego jetties in front. And then we handcrafted these big bluffs where a giant Lego insect chased Hermione Granger atop a Triceratops. But the crowning jewel was with the leftover bricks, we built a seawall that protected a Lego recreation of the Montauk Lighthouse. Honestly, it was protected by some Vikings and Yoda, so it's gonna be pretty good. And then we programmed the wave tank to simulate waves of a level 2 hurricane. And there is such horror, there is such glee watching the beach disappear and these mansions crumble into the water. Watching the seawall get buffeted, the sand disappears. And it is such a memorable lesson. The Empire should not have built their multi-billion dollar home, Death Star, so close to the beach. But it's a lesson that I also realize that these college students should have the opportunity to do so for themselves. And so I let those Legos stay. And now, I mean, hundreds of students have gone through that wave tank and been able to build and rebuild and create and really truly engage in learning about coastal processes. And I got new Lego sets that Christmas, and I built them. But when the children came over that next time, they got to see them too, because they were no longer squirreled away in my room. Thank you.
Jinsy over. You guys are the best. That was great. It was like a wave you could ride on the beach. Jinsy is a geographer with USGS. She likes to use the quote from Ken in the Barbie movie to describe her work. My job is just beach. All right, we're going to move right along. I do want to introduce a couple of people just because they're great. Vicky Merrick, who I work with on everything. Oh, she's up there. Yeah. And you all know her. And Sydney Lewis, we've all been working together for her. They're the best. We'll all be buried together. All right, our next storyteller, Beckett Colson. When I asked him what was the time you were into deep, he answered, "After my first deep sea deployment of a sensor I'd built, I fried it with seawater when I was opening it up to get the data. It was one of those stupid mistakes that stops you in your tracks and sinks in your stomach. I spent the next several days of the research cruise frantically rebuilding it. I had to hack something together with the spare parts I brought with me. I did it, and it was a whirlwind." Welcome, Beckett Colson.
I tied this bracelet on my wrist 11 years ago. It's been on here ever since. If I want to take it off, I have to cut it. I was fortunate enough in college to go on a study abroad program with Sea Education Association. It was a transatlantic crossing, starting here, right here in Woods Hole, and going all the way to Ireland. The expedition would take 30 days with no internet, and nothing but the waves, the sky, the wind, the ship, your shipmates, and yourself. And I was so excited. I was going to get to learn the names of all the lines that raised and lowered the sails. I was going to get to learn how to navigate with just paper and a compass. I was going to get to learn what science was like in the wild, in the ocean. And while I was on this trip, my project was looking at microplastics. And the way we measured microplastics was we would go and we'd get a bunch of water, we'd filter it out, and we'd take these little papers and look at them under a microscope. I learned really quickly that the fastest way to get seasick is to look through a microscope. So looking through that microscope, I was trying to figure out what all these different little objects were. There was like a copepod, which is like a shrimp-like organism. There were little gelatinous blobs. sometimes there were brightly colored specks that were, oh, that's clearly a microplastic. But often it was really hard to tell the difference. And so I would stare it through this microscope and then, whoop, I gotta take a break. Go outside, take a break, look at the horizon, come back. And I repeated this on, and I got slowly more time looking at the microscope. But throughout this 30-day expedition, it bothered me. Was this what science was? Was spending hours looking at this through this microscope, looking for little plastic particles, and telling just one data point in this vast ocean? And how was I to know that these little specks were microplastics? And how was I to compare with my lab mate, with scientists across the country, across the world? And so when I got off the ship and we had our sort of end of trip ceremony and tied these bracelets on ourselves, I made a promise to myself that I would work on this problem. And specifically that I would work on trying to make a microplastic sensor so that no poor sad student had to look through a microscope again. And so fast forward another few years, I ended up here at Woods Hole in grad school, and it's my first semester and it's time to suggest this idea to my advisor. And she's this hotshot scientist and I'm just starting out and I'm so nervous. And so I had built myself up over a few days, had exactly what I was gonna say, and I'm ready to go into this meeting. I'm pacing back and forth and I open the door and I just word vomit. I say everything really, really fast, and she calmly nods and listens. And when I finally finish, she says, "Yeah, that's a great idea. Let's write a proposal." And so we ended up getting some funding, and we built the first try at this system using an optical technique, using infrared light to detect microplastics. Now, there's a major problem with this plan. Water's really good at absorbing infrared light. And so we ended up needing to use this really powerful light source to do it. And long story short, it just didn't work. And so at the end of that stage, I was ready to cut this bracelet off. And I was so discouraged and ready to quit. But then the bracelet was there, and it had been there for 5 years. Might as well keep it on, right? And I decided I'd made this commitment to myself and that I would keep it and carry on. And so fast forward in another few years, I've got a new idea. Let's use electricity instead. And this idea didn't quite have funding, but I had a project class that I could build it for. And so I was in my apartment at my kitchen table. I had all the electronics spread out, wires going everywhere, just hobbyist electronics, anything I could get. And I had two coffee cups, one with water plus a cut-up piece of yogurt cup, and one with water plus grass clippings. And I would alternate flowing those through the sensor and try again. And eventually I got it on the last day, right before the final exam. You know, that's how that always goes. And I set up the sensor to have this red light and green light. So it would go red light when it's plastic, green light when it's not. And by gosh, it worked. And so this, thank you. And so this idea was enough of a proof of concept that we could take it on and leverage it to get some more funding. And I could spend more time working on it. And I'm proud to say I get to work on it all the time now. And every day we're consistently improving, getting towards a point where we have a microplastic sensor that works directly in water that'll tell you exactly what's there in real time. But I'm still not there yet. Every day I'm getting closer and closer to the day I get to cut this bracelet off.
Beckett Olson. Beckett's a research engineer at HUI. He's taken it out in the field. He's close to cutting off the bracelet a couple of times, but he's waiting till he has a slam dunk. You're listening to a Science Story Slam from Woods Hole, Massachusetts, presented by the Transom Story Lab at Atlantic Public Media. For more information and to hear this show online, go to transom.org or atlantic.org. Now we'll continue with the Science Story Slam from the Transom Story Lab at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. I'm your host, Jay Allison. Let's keep going. We're going to move right along. Sarah Ziegler, when I asked her what was a time you were in too deep, she answered, My first experience doing field work, I was alone doing mapping work on a barrier island off the coast of New Jersey. I took a wrong step and found myself stuck thigh deep in marsh mud, getting eaten alive by mosquitoes with the Atlantic City skyline in the distance. It sounds like the end of a Carl Hiaasen novel. Please welcome Sarah Ziegler.
Thank you. Oh boy. So I met one of the great loves of my life in June of 2021 at a commuter lot off of Massachusetts I-90. I was there to meet a staff member from Guiding Eyes for the Blind. She was there to deliver a van full of 8-week-old Labrador Retriever puppies to volunteer puppy raisers coming from all over New England. When I got to the van, I reached in and I opened the little door to this gray plastic crate, and all I could see were these big eyes staring back at me. And I reached in and I pulled out this impossibly tiny little ball of black velvet with the name Sumatra printed in big block letters across his collar. Several months before that moment, I had just purchased my first home. And the thing that was most exciting about that was that it was the first time in my adult life that I was no longer under a landlord's no dog policy. And I loved the idea of having a dog and having a companion during that part of COVID when we were still pretty confined to our homes. But while I knew I loved the idea of a dog, I also knew that I didn't really know the reality of that responsibility. And like any self-respecting scientist, when faced with uncertainty, I knew I needed to do more research. So it was not with a sense of altruism that I typed in service dog puppy raising near me in a search engine later that year. I figured, you know, if I raised a service dog for one of these organizations, I could learn what vet bills cost without actually pay them, learn how to train a puppy, and learn how one might actually fit into my relatively low responsibility single woman lifestyle. The night that I brought Sumatra home, I was very quickly confronted with the reality of an 8-week-old puppy. He got viciously carsick and he cried the entire 2-hour ride home. And he cried that night and several nights after that. And I would fall asleep laying next to his crate with my fingers through the front grate, trying to comfort him, thinking, just feeling so overwhelmed and terrified that I had made this horrible mistake. And this suddenly this year that we would be working together just felt like such a long time. But by the time of our first Guiding Eyes training class 2 weeks later, we had settled into a bit of a rhythm. I was getting a respectable 6 hours of sleep a night and waking up each morning in slightly less abject terror. And at this first class, me and another new puppy raiser, we were meeting outside of a mall in Kingston. We were instructed to sit on the sidewalk and just gently touch our puppies' ears and paws in a way to desensitize them to human touch. And the other puppy was bouncing around as you would expect from a now 10-week-old puppy, but Sumatra was still feeling awful from his car ride, and he crawled in my lap and immediately fell asleep. And I just sat there for the entire hour, just gently stroking his back, falling in love, just wondering how I became this little guy's safe space. Over the next year, the two of us worked really hard together. As the world began to reopen and he matured, we moved from parking lots to hardware stores to expertly navigating tight grocery store aisles. He learned commands like sit and down and stay, and I learned what it felt like to love with every cell of my body. And with each passing month, I questioned how I could possibly say goodbye to this little guy who had become so important to my life, because sometimes he was the only living creature I saw on a given day. But in June of 2022, not long after his first birthday, we received an email from Guiding Eyes saying that they were excited to welcome him back on October 16th for his temperament tests, and if that went well, then he would stay on at the training school to learn how to be a professional guide dog. Loving something so much and knowing the exact date that you would have to say goodbye seemed to alter the physics of time. These little, seemingly insignificant moments took on this weight, like the feeling of him sleeping along the tops of my feet and listening to him snore while I worked at my computer. But those months just seemed to blast by in the blink of an eye, and I found myself on October 16th walking into the training school in New York. There was a staff member waiting for us, and I handed her his leash. She took it and unhooked his collar. It was this bright green collar that looked so striking against his black fur, had his little name tag on it with my phone number that showed that at least for a little while he belonged to me. And she looped a metal collar around his neck and asked if I'd like to go walk back with him to the kennel where he would hopefully be spending the next 6 to 8 months. I shook my head because there was no way that words were going to be coming out of my throat at that point, and followed them back. And I sat on the floor of his kennel and watched as he darted around, sniffing all the little corners. And when I couldn't bear it anymore, I got up and I wrapped my arms around him. And I buried my face in the scruff of his neck and breathed in his funky little Frito smell. And I told him how much I love him, how proud of him I was. And I thanked him for bringing so much joy into my life during a time of such loneliness, and for teaching me how to love with my whole heart when heartbreak was a certainty. I left that day crying harder than I've ever cried in my entire life. And I had a lot of lovely friends and family reach out to me after that. And one particularly wise friend said that this was the act of service, not all those months of hard work and training, but the moment I handed his lease to a stranger and walked away willingly. I've had a lot of time to reflect on our time together, and I know that I poured all of my love and all of the very best parts of me into him. And he took that, and with every person that worked with him and fell in love with him, they did the same. And that love grew and multiplied and expanded, and he carried that out into the world. And I got to be part of that. And there's nothing like it. And so while I have not been able to let go of my boy, I have been able to loosen the grip just a little bit. And I'm happy to report that he's happy and healthy and living his best life working in Connecticut. And I'm currently raising my 4th guide dog puppy named Rick. And none of the goodbyes were any easier, but they have become more familiar and in that a little bit more bearable. Thank you.
Jeez, Sarah. Sarah Ziegler, yikes. Oh boy, oh boy. Sarah studies ecosystem change on barrier islands for USGS. She also has Sumatra's paw print is tattooed on her foot. She said it's the exact paw print she wanted me to know. I want to acknowledge somebody who is just a story conjurer, and I've worked with her for, I don't know, like 20 years almost, on the Moth Radio Hour. I don't know if you listen to the Moth, but she's one of the hosts and one of the great directors. And she lives in Sweden, and she came here to do this for us. And her name is Meg Bowles, and she's right here. And stand up. She's the best. And she worked with the aforementioned Vicky and Sophie and all these storytellers. It's going good so far, right? I mean, geez, it's like one other thing. I want to thank my friend. He's not here, George Logan, a great Woods Holer. He also lives in Virginia. Supports science and storytelling here in Woods Hole. Runs the Logan Fellowships for Science Journalists. Great guy. And then also Blake Hunter and Murphy Davis, my really good friends who have also supported our work through hard times like this one. And Murphy's right here, right there. Mm-hmm. All great people. I first came here in 1976. I directed the Woods Hole Theater Company in here. I directed The Rhymers of Eldritch by Lanford Wilson. And I wanted to build a set that went out here. I had scaffolding. There was going to be a tree house there. There was going to be the judge's bench up here. And I had I built it, a model of it. And then I showed Tom Renshaw, who's the guy who takes care of the building. Anyway, you can thank him for the fact that the building looks exactly as it did in 1976, because I got to build nothing. Julie Huber is next. When I asked her what was a time you were in too deep, she had answered two times. One, she said, the day I became a parent. And the other was, I always feel like I'm in too deep, but I like it that way. I'm a subsea kind of girl. Julie Huber.
Okay, it's August of 1998, and I am curled up in the fetal position on a dark and cold and dirty floor of a bathroom on a ship hauling itself all about in the North Pacific Ocean, puking my guts out, questioning all of my life choices. You see, this isn't what I thought a scientist looked like. I grew up in the Midwest, 1,000 miles from the ocean. I never knew a single scientist growing up, but somehow I'd convinced myself that I was going to be the next Jacques Cousteau. We shared a birthday, it was fate. And so in my brain, thanks to his books, the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, every day I was gonna put on a wetsuit and jump in this beautiful warm coral reef. There were gonna be sharks and smiling dolphins. But instead, I find myself in the North Pacific Ocean a few hundred miles off the coast of Oregon, above an underwater volcano, kind of wondering what went wrong. I was a brand new graduate student at the University of Washington, and a professor there had convinced me that this expedition was a really good idea, that I would kind of figure out my path. So we were at a volcano called Axial Seamount. It's about a mile deep. And earlier that winter, using underwater microphones, scientists had detected evidence for an eruption. But we were going to be the first eyes on the seafloor. We were going to send a remotely operated vehicle to the bottom of the ocean and see the aftermath of that eruption. So I wasn't feeling well, but I was really excited to see the seafloor. So just like everybody else, I kind of gathered around the screens and, you know, was really jazzed to see the bottom of the ocean. But at the same time, I kind of felt disconnected from the experience, right? I wasn't there. The vehicle was experiencing this environment. But when those first samples came up, a geologist handed me this beautiful, glassy, shiny black pillow basalt rock. And I distinctly remember him handing it to me. And he said, "Julie, this rock is like 6 months old." And I thought, oh, like we are floating on a planet that is 4.5 billion years old. And I'm holding this newborn rock. Right? Like these are some of the youngest rocks on the planet. And it was a very swoon-worthy moment. You know, forget dolphins, you know, magma uprising, lava erupting, life thriving on volcanic energy. I mean, I was obsessed. And so my love affair with Axial Seamount had begun. This was more than 25 years ago. I've traveled all around the world exploring underwater volcanoes, but I keep coming back to this one place. And like all long-term relationships, it's complicated. Axial has tested me. My first time as the scientist in charge of an expedition, I was faced with a really nasty weather report. And the captain and I were trying to decide if we should stay out or if we should go back into port. And I knew if we went back in, we wouldn't have time to come back out and do the rest of our work. So I asked the captain, "Do you think the ship can handle it?" It was a new ship to me. He said, "We'll be fine. We won't be able to work, but it'll be okay." So we decided to stay out. And then shortly before this storm came, the forecast got much worse. But by this time, all the ports from Vancouver down to San Francisco were closed. So we had no choice but to ride it out. And I distinctly remember watching the wind flip directions, the barometer dropped, and we saw this huge wind spike of about over 100 knots. And for the next 3 days, we were trapped inside with 60-knot winds, 15-meter waves, and I had to exit my zero-gravity cabin, which was beautiful, up forward, up top. I couldn't stay in bed. I thought I was going to die in the shower. I was walking at a 45-degree angle, and I found a really cozy corner in the midship library that I wedged myself into. But here I found myself again, at Axial Seamount, puking my guts out and questioning my life choices. But somehow Axial always got me back when I thought maybe we should, you know, settle down. And, you know, I met my husband on a research cruise to Axial Seamount. We're over 20 years into our marriage. I think he's finally willing to admit Axial's my first great love. I dove in the submersible Alvin for the first time at Axial, and I remember that feeling of falling through the water column, sort of losing the surface light, and then you get this whole amazing new light around you in the form of bioluminescence. And this time, you know, it was probably one of the most humbling and intimate experiences of my life. And then when I got the first glimpses of my shiny black seafloor, this time the only thing between us was a few inches of titanium. And, you know, once again, Axial had worked its magic. So I never really thought falling in love with a rock was a thing. And I certainly never thought that one of the most meaningful relationships in my life would be with an underwater volcano. And my career looks nothing like, you know, 12-year-old Julie living in the Midwest. But this one place in the deep ocean has brought me a lot, right? It's brought me amazing scientific discoveries, really wonderful colleagues, immense challenges, and just a lot of joy. And now I get to bring new scientists out to Axial, right? I get to kind of watch their faces light up when they get to see the shiny black C4. And then I just kind of sit back and Axial works its magic. Thank you.
Julie Huber. Axial magic. Julie's a senior scientist at HUI, oceanographer, and just her resume, she said, I do a lot of different things at the bottom of the ocean. Whatever. Michael Moore is our next storyteller. We're getting close to halfway. We're going to take a little break. It's going to be very, very short. And then we're going to keep going. When was the time Michael was in too deep? He said, leaping off a boat in front of a feeding humpback whale to identify the type of fish the whale was eating. That's deep. Michael Moore. Oh, somebody told me, probably they, Michael didn't want them to, but it's his birthday.
Maybe 30 years more, but anyway. North Atlantic right whales are magnificent, graceful, and tactile, highly tactile when in a group. When you see them from a drone with a mother suckling her calf and feeding herself, it's sublime. So I learned this first in the Bay of Fundy about 26 years ago. And while we were doing our panorama of right whale behavior, it was just amazing. This right whale showed up, and she had swum into a net on the bottom. It was a gill net. She had net one armpit, the other armpit over the back. And every time she swam, the net got tighter. It took 5 months to kill that whale. And when she died, she had lost a large patch of blubber over her back, in back of the blowhole. This was a poster child and a starting point for many of us in the business. And the idea of telling the story and figuring it out and using my veterinary, my science trainings was good. But I, at that moment, I became an advocate as well. 3 years on, Noah asked me to go look at a right whale that had been entangled, wrapped the line around the tail, and there was a little buoy wedged onto the notch of the tail. And every time it swam, it cut deeper into a little ring around the tail. And the aquarium had taken the line off the animal, but it died some weeks later. And it had come ashore in Nantucket. And there was a big swell, it was dead, and a strong westerly current, and the swell was breaking, big surf. And the whale was moving down the beach, rolling. It was an extraordinary sight, this dead whale rolling, the flukes are flapping, and it looked like it was swimming, but it was dead. So we got ahead of it down by the airport, dug a hole, put a big anchor in there with a line on it. The other end of the line, we waited for the whale to come by. And as the whale came by, we wrapped the line around the tail, and the tail was flapping around it in the hole. And tied it off. Whales came to a halt. The anchor held. I was standing on the anchor, and it was all good. And the trouble was that lines all go to the narrow part of the tailstock there, and this big fat line was in exactly the place that I wanted to examine, and it was all tight, and there was a big swell running still, and nothing to do. 2 days of storm, came back, I talked to Noah, and they said, well, what you got to do is you're going to let go of most of the whale, cut it off in front of the wounded tail, then bring the wounded piece back to the lab. So, okay, fine, I'll do that. So I got a knife, cut it off, and off it went. As I saw it go, it was like, oh, God, how do I do this? You know, it was just, it was the end of something and the beginning of something else, essentially. So I pledged right then to tell this whale story and tell its successor's story, publish, perish, publish again, and just publicize and present and fix. So took the chunk up the beach, and that was tough because the moving carpet of soil, of sand and gravel, pulling me down the beach with the tail. And a couple of times we almost went back and joined the whale, but we got up, and I got it back to the lab and took it apart. And whales have these huge flukes, and one of the things they do, they're big propellers too, but they are also radiators for heat. And what I found was that the veins draining the tail had been blocked by scar tissue, so there was no way that that whale could dump heat. So it lost a lot of weight during the rope wrapped around the tail, but also it was unable to maintain its body temperature. Mammals are homeothermic, they have to do that. So what does this all mean? Well, 15 years later, we'd done many more similar cases. They're all different, they're all unique, they're all animals, they could all tell their own stories. They had families, brothers, sisters, uncles, grandfathers, kids. These are families of whales, and it was just terrifying to see this all falling apart for them. But there is a ray of hope. In 2015, Massachusetts fishermen around Cape Cod were shut down from lobster fishing in the winter when the right whales are common to minimize the amount of rope in the water column from the trap up to the surface where they pull the trap up. So these fishermen worked with engineers, manufacturers, scientists, managers, funders to figure out how to do that trap retrieval without the rope in the water column. And they used an ancient technique that was developed in the 50s for acoustic release of objects from the bottom to the surface. And what has been so special for all of us involved in this work is the cooperation, the mutual respect, and the productivity and the pride in how we've all worked together to make it sustainable, not only for the fishermen, but also for the whales. And I hope and pray that in 10 years' time, I cannot be telling a story as now, it'll be then. Thank you.
Michael Moore. It's actually 35. He lied. Michael, by the way, he's an emeritus research scholar at HUI, and it wants to help humans understand the trauma that large whales undergo when hit by vessels and get entangled and create fundamental changes in how we value wildlife and biodiversity. I think that was probably clear. Amy Bauer is our next storyteller, and a time when you were in too deep, and this is not her story, but we'll have to do this again because she answered, when I was leading a research expedition in the Indian Ocean that was attacked by pirates with rifles and rocket-propelled grenades. But here she is with something else. Okay, well, welcome Amy Bauer.
I'm good. Great. Thank you. In 1979, when I was 19, I stepped on board the tall ship Westward here in Woods Hole for a 6 weeks hands-on introduction to oceanography and offshore sailing in the North Atlantic. I was super excited. I had grown up in a small coastal town in Massachusetts, messing around in small boats and falling in love with the ocean. I was also a sciencey kid, so this idea of science under sail sounded like just an impossibly best dream adventure. And there we go. But the first 3 days did not go well at all. I found myself flat on my back in my bunk with debilitating seasickness. I thought I was gonna die. Then I was afraid I wasn't gonna die. It was that bad. Meanwhile, my classmates from the Midwest, who'd never seen the ocean and never been on any boat of any kind, were scampering around on the deck as happy as clams while I was down below. It was not a good day for the Massachusetts coastal kid. But after a few days, I started to feel better, and I was able to join my classmates on deck and start to learn the ropes. And it was none too soon, because the first night I was back on deck, there was a big storm brewing, and it was all hands on deck to haul down Westward's massive sails. I distinctly remember clinging to the bowsprit, balancing on these ratlins, these ropes hanging under the bowsprit, with the bow plunging into the growing swells and cold North Atlantic seawater filling my boots on every plunge. So the sound of the waves, the wind, the flapping sail was so loud we could hardly hear the captain's orders. It was complete chaos, and I was in heaven. The physics I'd been studying in college was suddenly not theoretical anymore. I was actually feeling and experiencing the important physical forces that helped to shape our planet. It was at that moment that I decided I wanted to be a physical oceanographer. I wanted to go to sea on ships, make observations of ocean currents, and discover new things about how and why the oceans move. I was ready. Later on that same trip, I was assigned at night to bow watch, which meant I needed to spend several hours standing alone at the bow, watching for any lights of ships that might be getting too close. If I saw anything, I was supposed to walk back to the stern and alert the mate on duty. So being the good Girl Scout that I was standing on the bow of the ship, and I'm scanning around, looking at darkness everywhere. Dark ocean, dark sky, nothing going on around here. But I'm doing my thing, But suddenly, the mate steps up beside me, and he says, "Amy, don't you see that light over there?" I looked where he was pointing, and I didn't see the light. I saw darkness, only darkness. Then I squinted my eyes, I looked out of the corner of my eye a little bit, and I saw a dim, flickering light in the distance. Clearly, he had seen the light much sooner, and so should have I. This was the first sign that maybe something wasn't quite right with my vision. Several years later, when I was a graduate student, a routine eye exam revealed an unusual blind spot in my eyesight. Before I knew it, I was sitting in the office of a specialist at Mass Eye and Ear Infirmary in Boston, and he was telling me that I was going to slowly lose most, if not all, of my vision in the coming years due to a degenerative retinal disease that had no cure. I was stunned. I'd never heard of this disease. No one in my family had it, even though it has genetic roots. I didn't know a single blind person, and that means I didn't know a single blind oceanographer or any scientist in any field, for that matter, who was blind. Could I still be a physical oceanographer with low or no vision? I wasn't sure. But I had no plan B either. I just wanted to be a physical oceanographer who goes to sea and collects observations and has all these cool adventures. So the well-intended specialist suggested to me that, with sort of cheerfulness, that, oh, but I could switch gears in my studies to science administration instead of research. And with all due respect to those administrators out there, and I know there are some, that's not what I wanted to do then at that time in my life. I wanted to go to sea and make new discoveries about the ocean. So I set aside that specialist advice, and I continued my journey to be a physical oceanographer. Over the years, I've been able to solve many of the challenges associated with losing my vision with the support of family and friends and colleagues. For example, I figured out there's actually non-visual ways to access the data that I collect. But the most stubborn obstacle all along has been my own self-doubt. And this, I have to say, is something I have not yet conquered. It's something I just live with, and in spite of it, I've had the honor and the privilege to lead numerous research expeditions to the North Atlantic and the Indian Ocean over the past 30 years. And whenever I go to sea, white cane in hand, and I feel the rolling deck under my feet and the wind in my face, and I hear the hissing sound of the waves as they pass the ship, I'm in heaven again. Thank you.
Amy Ballard. Come on. That's so good. Amy's a senior scientist at HUI. She told us what she was working on, but there were three of us standing there, and then we all made this face. And then she said, I work on the Great Ocean Conveyor. Okay, so you guys sound really great. I'm, don't lose this energy, because it's helping. It's lifting everybody up, and it feels fantastic. Just a few minutes, this a leg stretch, and then Carla's going to play some more, and we'll just finish this out, okay? Thank you.
This has been a special broadcast of Making Waves, a science story slam recorded in Woods Hole in June of this year and produced by Transom and Atlantic Public Media. That leg stretch Jay Allison mentioned will be a bit longer than a few minutes. We'll bring you the second hour of Making Waves tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. and again at 7 p.m. Thanks for listening.